Good morning. You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hartzinski. NPR correspondent Kelly McEvers spent the past 3 years based in Beirut, Lebanon, and extensively covered the uprisings across the Middle East that became known as the Arab Spring. She was in Oklahoma earlier this month for a public talk and panel discussion led by the host of KGOU's Worldviews, Suzette Gralat. We've recorded and produced that entire discussion for broadcast. KGOU's general manager, Karen Holp, opened the presentation.
Let me introduce Kelly. As NPR's international correspondent, Kelly has traveled undercover to follow the Arab Spring uprisings, and she has hunkered down with underground activists in Bahrain, Yemen, and Syria. She's been tear-gassed in Bahrain. She spent the night in a tent city with a Yemeni woman who would later share in the Nobel Peace Prize, and she has spent hours with the shadowy group of anti-government rebels known as the Free Syrian Army. In Iraq, she covered the final withdrawal of U.S. troops and the political chaos that has gripped the country since. And before arriving in Iraq in 2010, Kelly was one of the first Western correspondents to be based full-time in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. In 2012, she was awarded the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia Award, the Peabody Award, the Gracie Award, and an Overseas Press Club citation. Before covering the Middle East, Kelly was covered Southeast Asia and the former Soviet Union. Now back in the U.S., she's going to be taking on a new role as correspondent for National Public Radio's National Desk, based in Los Angeles. So please welcome Kelly McEvers.
Thank you so much, KGOU and the College of International Studies. This is a tall lectern. I'm in heels, and I can't see you. I also realized I got a sunburn today. I just moved to L.A., but I got to come to Oklahoma to get, like, sun and heat. What's going on? Thanks so much for having me. I'm going to talk for just a few minutes and play a few radio clips about my experiences in the Middle East. As Karen said, I was a reporter based in the region, off and on really for the past 8 years, starting in Beirut just after the Israel-Hezbollah war there, and moving on to cover the Gulf for many years, later Baghdad, Saudi Arabia, and eventually being based in Beirut, where I mostly covered Syria. I want to talk about my experiences not because I'm just so like enamored with myself, but because I think sort of hearing some of those early stories from this thing we call the Arab Spring kind of helps give us context. A lot of people, when I come and talk to folks in different towns around the states or stations, I think a lot of people say, oh, the Middle East, boy, it sure is a mess now. It's gotten really violent, and I guess that Arab Spring thing didn't go very well, huh? You know, it's all really sort of devolving into violence, and that's pretty much what we expected, and too bad. I think if we kind of go back a little bit and talk about how it all started and how it changed, the Arab Spring, I talk about it as if it's one thing, how these uprisings in all these countries changed over time, I think it'll give us just a little bit of context to the news that you're hearing today. May help sort of, you know, deepen the understanding about how things are going now. In 2010, I was sent to Iraq for National Public Radio, and the assignment was to be based there and to not miss a day in Iraq. Our foreign editor at the time was one of those old-school journalists. You know, he'd been on the last plane out of Saigon, one of the last helicopters out of Saigon, you know, the last moment. You know, we were going to be the last men standing in Iraq. We were going to cover every single day that American troops were based in Iraq. And so I was prepared to do that. And then in late 2010, a young man in Tunisia set himself on fire and literally changed everything. You know, it took a little while for us to realize what was going on. But first it was the protests in Tunisia, protests about his eventual death that led to the ruler of that country to step down. Protests that then erupted in Egypt, Yemen, Libya, Bahrain, and eventually Syria. protests that would be called the Arab Spring. But I don't know. It's hard for you who you weren't there. I mean, it was just for somebody who was there, who was at first I was watching it on TV in Baghdad, sitting there thinking, do we really have to stay in Baghdad? Come on, you know, put me in coach, put my hand up, asking to be sent out on the stories. First watching it on TV on Al Jazeera and then eventually going out and watching it on the streets with my own eyes in the field in many different countries. It's hard to impart how absolutely momentous this was, how enormous this was, how we even then could see what a huge, enormous moment in history this was going to be, what a game changer it was. Here you had tens of millions of people taking to the streets across an entire region demanding something different. I mean, that's really what it was. That's how it started. And I think we forget that when we look at Syria now, we look at Egypt, we look at Libya. It was about mostly young people, mostly, you know, well-educated young people who were just sort of coming out and asking for something different. My first assignment was in Bahrain. This is a tiny little island country in the Persian Gulf, or the Arabian Gulf, depending on who you are. And in Bahrain, there were hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. And Bahrain's a small place. It was something like a third of the population had gone out in the streets to protest. I mean, it was like the world, for me, seeing it was like the world's biggest state fair or something. I mean, it was just like, there was popcorn, there was singing, there were grandmas, you know, I mean, it was, there was people making speeches, people who'd never done anything like that before in their lives. It lasted for a month. And at some point, there were some backroom negotiations going on. I think in the beginning, the people weren't even asking for the regime to fall down. They were just asking for reform. In the end, the government decided they weren't having it. With the help of Saudi Arabia, they cracked down on this massive protest in this big square in the center of town, set tents on fire, sent in Apache helicopters, shot people, beat them up, and drove them out of the square, and eventually actually bulldozed the monument that was at the heart of the square, as if to say, it's over. And then what happened? Like in so many of these countries, you know, when these regimes see that they're in danger, what do? They want to stop the protests, and they want to stop people from telling the world about the protests. So they kick out all the journalists. They put all the protesters in jail. And if they don't put them in jail, they publicly shame them. In Bahrain, they had a particular tactic of posting photographs of people on Facebook, people who had been protesting, and then there would be red circles around the faces of those that they, you know, who they were regular protesters or protest organizers. The next day, that person might go to work and be told they're not welcome anymore. Or worse, you know, in the middle of the night, they might be taken away and thrown in jail. This actually happened to elected officials. The equivalent of congressmen in Bahrain were rounded up in the middle of the night, taken away in cars by plainclothes people, and held incommunicado for months. This is what people in Bahrain called the crackdown. The government decided it was over. And so there was no way for a journalist to get in. I was very anxious to go and cover this. I had a lot of contacts in Bahrain. I'd reported on the country before when I'd lived in Saudi Arabia. And it was a story that I felt like was worth telling. This is a major ally of the United States, that we have a Navy base based in Bahrain. We have arms arrangements with Bahrain. You know, the United States has influence in Bahrain. The United States, as an ally of Bahrain, needed to know this story. So I heard about this. Journalists weren't allowed. I mean, that was just not going to happen. But I'd heard about this e-visa service that was still being offered by the Bahraini embassy in Washington. A friend told me about it, and I thought, well, I'll just apply, see if it works. And I put in my passport number thinking, surely they're going to run my passport, figure out who I am, like not give me the visa. 24 hours later, I got it. I was like, okay. It was like a business visa. So I showed up at the airport, and they were like, oh, this is a business visa. You're here on business. I was like, well, yes, I am. That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm totally here. And they're like, who do you, what are you, what's your business? And I was like, I'm a consultant. They said, for who? And I said, J.P. Morgan, which I really to this day don't understand why I said that. But and I didn't bring any recording equipment. I mean, I was, you know, I was undercover. Like, I didn't want them to know I was there. You know, the activists who were, you know, still trying to organize protests and were keeping track of the detentions and the beatings and the human rights abuses, they were under, you know, they were reachable by Skype. We couldn't talk on the phone. You know, I remember like hiding under my bed at one point because I thought for sure somebody was in the hallway listening to me, maybe just a little paranoid. But I'd heard at the time that not only were they rounding up protesters and protest organizers, but that they had started targeting women. And in a Gulf country, in an Arab country at all, but in a Gulf country in particular, this is just a bad thing to do. It's very insulting. You know, come into a home, take a woman out, and put her in prison. It's a very, very bad thing to do. And so I tried to find out about one woman who I knew who had been through this. She'd been detained. She'd been beaten. Her husband was in jail. And the beating was almost as if to say, keep quiet. Don't talk about it. We'll let you out. We'll beat you. We'll let you out. But just don't talk about what's happening. So once I finally met this woman, she said she was willing to tell me her story, but not on tape. Well, when you're a radio reporter, you sort of need people to talk on tape. So what she did finally agree to do was talk to me, but she did it. She had to do it in a whisper because it was the only way she felt like she wouldn't be recognized by the authorities. So I'm just going to play you a clip because I want you to just kind of get a feel of what it's like to live under a crackdown.
Authorities detained hundreds, then thousands of men who were known to oppose the government. Then they went after the women.
They took me from my work, and from the beginning, they slapped me on my face, on my head, shoulder.
This woman was recently detained, beaten, then let go. When we met, she was limping from pain. She agreed to be recorded only if she could whisper in English, so authorities won't recognize her voice. The woman says she was taken by bus to a police station, blindfolded, and made to stand for 5 hours in a room. She was accused of working to bring down the Bahraini regime.
They tried to force me to confess that I told people at my work to be against the regime.
Authorities showed the woman a picture of someone protesting at Pearl Roundabout. At the time, Bahrain's crown prince said it was legal to protest. Now, authorities say it's a crime.
They tried to force me to confess that a picture in a protest is my picture, and it was really not my picture.
They taunted the woman about one of her relatives, who's been jailed without charge for many weeks.
They said very bad things about him, and they told me that, do you think he will come out of the jail? He will be dying in the jail.
But perhaps the worst part of the ordeal was that the woman was detained at all. In an Arab culture, particularly in the Gulf, detaining a woman is the ultimate humiliation. Going back to the days when the way one tribe defeated another was to capture and rape its women.
They told me if I didn't confess, they will let men come and continue with me. They told me that.
And the threat was clear. They meant the men will do very bad things to you.
Yes, I understood.
They were saying that we'll let these men come and rape you.
No, they didn't say that, but to beat, but strong and hardly beat.
Okay, so that the men would beat you even harder because they're men.
Yes, yes.
Did you ever feel like you were in danger of something worse, of some kind of sexual attack?
Maybe, yes. Maybe.
If we thought the crackdown in Bahrain was bad, then came Syria. The Syrians waited to rise up. They were sort of the last of the Arab countries to rise up in great numbers. It was March 2011, and although there were a few small protests in Damascus on the 15th of March, a lot of people say that the uprising started on the 18th in a place called Daraa. I know a guy very well who was there that day. He's one of these people that over the last 2.5 years I've just gone back to and checked in with over and over again to sort of watch how he's changed over the years, is to sort of understand how the Syrian uprising has changed. But that day, he's kind of this iconic figure because he was there in that very first protest. He was praying in a mosque, and he and his friends had decided that they were going to, after the prayer on Friday, they were going to walk outside the mosque, just walk out on the street and just start saying things like freedom, change. I mean, they weren't calling for the downfall of the regime yet at that point either. And then they were going to meet up with some guys from another mosque. Everybody was going to kind of walk out on the street, meet up together, and say some stuff. And I remember him telling me the story of how he had torn a big flour sack into a big, just basically a huge white flag, and he had it, and he was just waving it like this, you know, as if to say, you know, this is, we're cool, we're peaceful, and it ended up being a For a long time, it was sort of the icon on Al Jazeera when they talked about Syria. It was sort of like this guy Ibrahim, waving his big white flag and sort of open chest as if to symbolize, you know, we're here, we're unarmed, we just want to protest. That first day, four protesters were shot and killed in broad daylight. The guy standing right next to Ibrahim, the guy he went to grade school with, he picked him up, he put him in a car, and he carried him home. And at that moment, there was sort of this moment where it seemed like maybe the government from Damascus had sent down some envoys and there was maybe a way that there was going to be kind of some negotiation. How can we talk about this? Let's calm things down. You know, let's think about sort of reparations to the family. Those talks broke down. Depends on who you talk to as to whose fault it was. But what happened then was what? And this is really, this explains so much about the Arab uprisings, is you had people killed and the people angry about it. So what do the people angry about it do? They protest more. And when they go to protest, what happens? They get killed. And so they get killed, so there's another funeral and there's another protest, and this is how the cycle began. I think when people, you know, ask me about Syria now, they say, oh, it's a place where people have been fighting for centuries, right? And I say, no, actually, no. It's a place where an uprising started and people were killed. And then various reactions followed. So a few months into the Syrian uprising, was able to get a visa to go into the country. Actually, it was a tour being led by the government called Syria is Fine. And Surya Bekhair. It was actually a tour for journalists and kind of like analysts and stuff from countries that were favorable to the Syrian regime. So it was Venezuelans and Iranians and Russians and then me. and it was an Iraqi friend of mine had sort of talked a friend of his into kind of getting me on the group, and it seemed fine. And so there were a lot of tours, you know, a lot of showing us, like, how, look, Syria's fine. There's none of these, nobody's protesting. Nobody's angry. This was just after Ramadan in August of 2011. This was just after you had seen massive protests in the city of Hama. And, you know, by some counts, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe more like tens of thousands. But, you know, pictures from that time, lots and lots of people protesting in the streets. And at the end of Ramadan, there were about 200 protesters killed. The government claims that, you know, protesters at that point were throwing rocks, building barricades with dumpsters, picking up guns to defend themselves. It's hard to know what precipitated the killing, but we do know that 200 people were killed that Ramadan, which now seems like such a small number. But at the time, it was shocking. So the regime took us to Hama to show us that, you know, Syria's fine. Just because we shot some people, now everything's fine. We've cleaned the streets. It's all clean. It's all good. It's fine. I remember they took us in to meet the governor, and he gave a speech. And then we came outside and across the street. We were in these buses. I mean, it was clear we were with the government. And these about 50 guys across the street staged a protest, obviously in our honor. You know, they wanted to show, well, look, there's journalists, there's the government, we're going to protest. We're going to stand here and say, Ashab yurid iskat al-nizam. We want the people want the fall of the regime. They had their faces covered because they didn't want to be identified because they were so terrified of what was going to happen to them if the government knew who they were. And I remember one guy running over to me. It's the first time in my career as a journalist when I actually told somebody not to go on the record, not to speak into my microphone. I said, don't do it. I said, do not talk to me. Because I knew what was going to happen to him if he did. He did. He said, no, I'm aware of what's going on. I want you to hear this. You need to know. The world needs to know what's going on. He had his face covered, and he said into my, you know, microphone, he said, we don't have electricity. We don't have internet. But I got to tell you, they're rounding us up. They're putting us in jail. And please tell the world our story. And as soon as he was done, a car pulled up and took him away. And I worked and worked and worked for weeks and months trying to figure out what happened to him. And I couldn't. This is a time when people in areas of protest, people in areas of opposition, young boys would be taken into jail, tortured to death, and then the body would be sent back to the town or the village as a message. This is what happens. You know, this is what happens when you oppose the government. So this is what this kid was afraid of. Anyway, a couple nights later, I was in Damascus, and I actually wasn't feeling well. But I sort of begged off the official dinner for the night and had managed through a bunch of different contacts on Skype and secure lines to arrange a meeting with an activist, a protest organizer at the time. And he took me to a neighborhood called Duma, and it was Maidan. I wanted to see what a protest was like. I was like, are there really protests? You know, we were getting all these videos and all these accounts from inside Syria, but I needed to see it for myself. I wasn't sure. And so anyway, he took me to one, and I'm just going to sort of play what it sounds like and what it feels like. Back in the car, we see security forces on their way to... Oh, yeah, okay. So I'll just set it up a little bit. It was a Friday. It was during Ramadan, so it was after the extra nightly prayer. So it's a little bit late. I sort of dressed in sort of traditional dress. I wore a hijab, and he was dressed as well. So we kind of looked like we were just relatives going out, you know, to the mosque, like, after prayer. And we got in the car. We're sort of driving to where we'd heard the protest was going to be.
Back in the car, we see security forces on their way to the nightly prayer.
So that's a green bus. Yep, it's a regular transportation bus.
Yes.
But it's full of men, all in plain clothes. Oh, wow, more. One, two busloads full of what they call shabiha.
The shabiha are government-sponsored thugs who carry rifles, clubs, and tasers. They take their buses to mosques, then wait outside to keep people from gathering. We decide to make our own plan.
So if something happens, we'll just separate. I won't see you again. I'll just find my way. I'll get a taxi and I'll go home.
Yes.
We pull over and wait for the prayer to finish.
I forgot to say, the reason you don't hear his voice and you only hear me is because he couldn't be on tape either. He was so afraid to be on tape or be described on tape or anything. So I'm just narrating what's going on because I can't use his voice because he was so afraid.
I'll go home.
Yes.
We pull over and wait for the prayer to finish. The activist gets out first and tells me to wait. Then he comes right back.
Please hurry, they start
it's
the
happened.
Demonstration.
Okay.
Yes.
But should I have my bag in the car?
Yeah.
Okay.
I hide my phone in my sleeve. It's doing all the recording.
Yeah, that's right.
We see a group of maybe 30 protesters walking very fast down a dark and narrow alley. You can hear them chanting in the background. We run to catch up. Then we hear the cars. The activist says that's a warning sign. The security forces are coming. The protesters surge back toward us.
Everybody's running down the street. Everybody's running like crazy. We're leaving.
The activist calls me mama and grabs my arm. We're trying to look like we have nothing to do with the protest. The activist says they could arrest us at any minute. So we do our best to stay calm. We make it back to the car.
Okay, that was fast. That sound was a sound grenade. We saw the flash just to our left as we were running back through the alley. Now things are, you know, acting normal. So when you go around Damascus and everybody says, oh, look, it's normal, it's like, well,
it's
sort of.
Later, after I left Damascus, I talked to the activist on a secure line. I've asked him to check in with me, so I know he's all right. Every day, one of us is arrested and tortured, he says. One day, my time is coming. Until the world realizes what's happening in Syria, he says, they will try and get us all. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
They did get him. A few months later, not because of that, because of something else. He had a satellite phone in his backpack. Of course, that's reason to go to jail. They hung him from his wrists for 4 days at a time. Couldn't touch the ground. They eventually let him go. But, you know, the message was clear. Don't come back to Syria. Don't do any more of this work. He ended up in a country outside of Syria. I just actually got an email from him the other day. He's gone back inside. He's trying to find a way to just get out of the region completely. A lot of things have happened since then in Syria and a lot of these countries. But I feel I just wanted to do some, just give you kind of, let you hear and feel sort of what it was like in the beginning and give you a sense of why things turned out the way, I don't, maybe give you just a little context for why things turned out the way they did. Of course, in Syria, what happened later is, and not much later than this, people started picking up guns, you know. I mean, definitely, you know, they tried to say for a long time that it was a peaceful revolution, and we know that that's not true. We know that in response to the detentions and torture, that people picked up weapons. They picked up guns. At first, they said they were sort of defending protests. Maybe that was happening. But, you know, then they went on the offensive. They formed militias. They formed rebel organizations. They started calling themselves the Free Syrian Army, and they started fighting back against the government. Now, of course, that movement has gotten completely fractured and is a is a lot of different militias sort of under this one umbrella. We've seen jihadists come into the game. It's become very dangerous. As journalists, we can't hardly even go in anymore into northern Syria because of the presence of the jihadists. So it's a lot of things have happened since then, but I hope if you come away with anything, it's just sort of this foundation of what kind of the Arab uprisings and these brutal crackdowns really were in the beginning. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, for the conversation, because we have such resources at the university, most of them on the air at KGOU, which I think is a very good thing, we decided we'd also make this a good conversation, but I think there's things to learn when people share ideas. So moderating will be the host of Worldviews on KGOU and that dean, Dr. Suzette Grelot. She's also known as the dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the William J. Crow Jr. Chair in Geopolitics. I have a page of bio. She teaches courses on international relations, international security, American foreign policy, politics of Central and Eastern Europe, and many other ones I cut off the list. Her research focus interests are on weapons proliferation, transnational advocacy networks, inter- and intrastate conflict and its resolution, and the social psychology of state behavior, among others. She's published many articles in the British Journal of Political Science, International Politics, Political Psychology, the Nonproliferation Review, the Journal of Southern Europe and the Balkans, and more. And it keeps going on. She's also writing a book about arms proliferation and disarmament, and is working on a book called Small But Deadly, The Spread and Control of Light Weapons in Eastern Europe. Welcome to the stage. I wrote equally long ones for the rest. Dr. Joshua Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies and associate professor at the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. He teaches political Islam, international relations in the Middle East, the modern Middle East, cultural and society in the Middle East, and the U.S. in the Middle East. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter blog on Syrian politics. He has some 50,000 readers a month, and it's widely read by officials in Washington, Europe, and Syria. He travels frequently to Washington, D.C. to consult with agencies and think tanks, and I'll skip some of those. He also appears on every media we know, TV and radio, most recently PBS, The Charlie Rose Show, Al Jazeera, Frontline, NPR, and BBC Radio. And he often does that from the studios of KGOU, I'm very happy to say. Dr. Samer Shahada is Associate Professor of Middle Eastern Politics at the Department of International and Area Studies at the University of Oklahoma in the College of International Studies, and has previously taught at Georgetown University, New York University, Columbia University, and American University in Cairo. His research interests include Middle East politics, Islamic politics and movements, U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East, the political economy of the Middle East, and Egyptian politics, among many. He is widely published in both academic and policy journals. He apparently also... he appears... No, I'm going to read this. Okay. You may... And just, I'm making a list because I'm going to see who's appears on in more media. He gives interviews to CNN, BBC, PBS, NPR, ABC, CBS, MSNBC, Fox, C-SPAN, CBS, Al Jazeera English, Al Arabiya, Egyptian Satellite TV, Middle East Broadcasting Company, New York Times, Washington Post, Christian Science Monitor, and I left a whole bunch off the list. So we thank you all very much for coming here and doing this. At the end, we will have time for some questions. We will have KGOU staff in the audience with a microphone. Please don't try to ask a question unless you are mic'd so that we can make it part of the broadcast when we eventually get this on the air. So we'll come to you with your question, raise your hand, and staff will find you in kind of order that we see your hand up. So thank you very much. Let's begin, moderator.
Thank you, Karen. Well, I'm going to take the liberty of the moderator to thank Karen Hulp and everyone at KGOU, Jim Johnson, Jolly Brown, who was instrumental in organizing this and bringing Kelly to campus, and, of course, our illustrious radio engineer and producer of KGOU's Worldviews, Brian Hardzinski, for all the work that they do and for hosting such great public events. And so with that, I'd like to thank them and to wish them a happy 30th anniversary. I had to do it. Sorry. Well, so thank you, Kelly, so much for your comments and very interesting and very interesting stories, very heartbreaking stories, in fact. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I think there's so many things to say. We only have so much time. But I thought I would begin with allowing Joshua and Samar, our two amazing faculty members here at the University of Oklahoma, to react to some of the things that you said, Kelly. And first I'll start with you, Samar. If you could tell us, I mean, Kelly was talking about, she was kind of characterizing the beginning of her comments, the Arab Spring, as a series of uprisings and violent crackdowns that led to more uprisings, and that, you know, this was kind of the main crux of what we saw happen and what we continue to see happening in the Middle East in many of these countries. Could you give us some reaction to that in terms of your perspective on this, you know, characterization of the Arab Spring?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, I immediately and intuitively understood and agreed fully with that characterization. And in fact, I'm writing something along those lines. I mean, if we look at what happened in Tunisia between December 17th, when Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire, and January 14th, or if we look at what happened in Egypt between January 25, the first day of the protests, and February 11, when Mr. Mubarak was ousted or when he resigned, what we see is regimes not knowing really how to deal with popular uprisings on this scale. And for the most part, they deal with them in a kind of ham-fisted and repressive way, which leads to deaths, which then leads to more protests. And it not only leads to more protests, it leads to something else. It leads to an escalation of the demands of the protesters. So nobody in Tunisia in December of 2010, or maybe even, you know, the first days of January 2011, were really calling for Bin Ali to leave the country. They were calling for more freedoms, political reform, and so on. The same thing we know, and I know, you know, very well because I work on Egypt, the same thing occurred in Egypt. Really, most people who were out on the streets on the first day, the first two, three, 4 days in Egypt, January 25 till about January 28, 29, were not really calling for the overthrow of Mubarak. They were calling for the dismissal of the interior minister. They were calling for other kinds of political reform, constitutional amendments, and so on. But the regime reacted with tremendous violence and killed people. And the demands that the protesters then made escalated. And then they started becoming ishabiri disqat al-nizam. The people want to topple the regime and so on. So I think that's very correct. And I think I'll just say one other thing, which is you characterized, I think, quite well. You brought out the aspirations and the feelings and the hopes that many of us had so intensely at the time, and I still harbor. And, you know, in those early months when Bin Ali was ousted, this is someone who had been in power since 1987, Zain al-Abidine Bin Ali in Tunisia. When Mubarak was ousted, he had been in power since October 6th, 1981, 29 and a half years. When they were ousted and when it seemed as if democracy, political participation, good governance, and so on, rule of law, which is in some ways so much more important than any of these other things, and so on, when it seemed that this was a possibility, we thought that this was going to be an incredible, monumental, historical change in the region that could lead to fundamentally different relationship between the Arab world and the rest of the world, which would lead to very positive from the perspective of many of us, consequences with regard to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And we thought this would be the beginning of an Arab Renaissance. And I think there's still the possibility of that. Unfortunately, what we've learned in the Syrian case and in other cases, even in Tunisia and Egypt, is that autocrats don't give up power easily and that there are real things at stake in this, having to do with privilege and wealth and position and so on. We're seeing that in many of the regimes, including in the Egyptian one. So I think I'll stop there, but certainly I want to get across that there was so much hope, and I think there still deserves to be a significant amount of hope in terms of what the Arab uprisings could accomplish. One has to understand how historically significant they were. This is a region of the world that was characterized, the Arab Middle East in particular, was characterized by enduring authoritarian regimes. The question that political scientists asked, it was a problematic question, but there was some truth in it, was why is it that this region seems immune to democracy and to democratization? We've seen democratization in East Asia, in Latin America, in sub-Saharan Africa, certainly in Europe, Eastern Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall. But why is it that from Morocco to Saudi Arabia and Iraq before the Iraq debacle, and even today, authoritarianism is still so very much entrenched, right? And so this had brought many of us hope that this would be the end of that, and that in fact there would be, and there was, a kind of domino effect. And that's what we saw. Tunisia falling, Egypt falling, Libya, Yemen, Bahrain almost falling, Syria, and so on.
So I would like to just push on that issue a little bit further, and with you, Joshua. I mean, what I'm hearing from Samer and seeing some agreement here from Kelly is that this is an issue of political reform. I mean, they're pushing for political reforms and freedoms. But I've heard you often talk about the economic situation in the region and the economic underpinnings of as far as a cause for the Arab Spring. So could you tell us a little bit about that? And also on this note of authoritarianism and authoritarian regimes, I mean, you know, they're all enduring authoritarian regimes, as Samer said, but we also see very different responses in some places, and we don't see an even outcome. I mean, the outcome in Tunisia and Egypt was different than the outcome in Bahrain and different from the outcome in Syria. So given we have some very similar situations, what could explain that very different outcome?
Well, the polarization in the Middle East, it's hard for Americans, I think, to understand this sort of polarization. We're witnessing a real polarization in class in America, which gives us a little taste of the sort of yawning divide that can exist. We don't feel any of the real resentments, or very few of them, compared to the Middle East. But in the Middle East, the polarization is big, and it's in many different ways. We've heard about the class issue in Egypt and how the aspirations for freedom kindle all sorts of other demands, demands for more Islam versus the seculars, for social justice, for the poor people against the rich elites. And that has caused this struggle to become much more difficult in Egypt. In Syria and in the like Lebanon, Iraq, Palestine, Israel, there's also an ethnic dimension and a religious dimension which makes them so difficult. And when I hear the narrative as told, as we've heard it here tonight, which is these were gentle demands for reform, government was brutish, killed the people, and they became more radical. That's exactly what happened. But it's also, it elides over a story of intense brutality that has been going on for decades. And when I first got to the Middle East in 1979, the year of the Iranian Revolution, I was teaching in Beirut, which was in the middle of civil war between Christians and Muslims. And a friend came over to dinner once with her boyfriend, who was a militia guy, and he had a string of ears on his on a wire that he had collected off of dead bodies, and he would show them around. And these were, this is a Christian guy who had Muslim ears. The next year, I went over to Syria when the Hama revolt broke out, And I lived in Syria when the Muslim Brotherhood rose up against the government dominated by Alawites, who are a non-Muslim, quasi-Muslim group. And they wanted these quasi-Muslims out. And it took on this religious dimension that became very brutal very quickly. And the government stomped it out, killing 20,000 people. When those innocent kids in Deraa demanded reform, they didn't know what little light they were kindling, because there was this long history. And the youth, the average age in Syria today is 21 years old. That means half of the population are below 21. And if you take below 35, you know, it's two-thirds of the country. And those people don't remember Hama in 1982. They don't know the terrible tensions that exist between these people. Everybody's polite to each other. The society is so suppressed by this government that's policing over it that once those demands are heard, and for anybody who is sort of older and had lived through these very violent episodes, when you heard, oh, we want political freedom, immediately that means we want Alawites out and we want Sunni Muslims in. And that's what the regime is hearing. The regime is hearing sectarianism. It's not sectarianism in the mouths of these children. But the fathers and the parents behind them, it is sectarianism. And the regime knows it, and they know, I've got to kill this person before it catches on. I've got to stop that demonstration before it overtakes society. And that's what they're trying to do. They couldn't do it. They failed. And society has blown up in this sectarian, horrible conflagration. And we're going to lose this generation, I fear, the generation that Kelly was telling us about, of those young, smart, well-educated activists who could take her around, speak English to her, who are educated, and who are working Facebook, Twitter. They were savvy, of which only about 10 or 15% of Syrians can be, because that's only how many, what percentage are on Facebook and have internet. So it's a thin layer at the top who are privileged enough and have the money to do it. But that class has left Syria today and will probably never go back. There's a whole different world that has grown up in a different leadership that is emerging in Syria today. And the exiles and the people that America has organized to try to float them back into Syria to be a next government are being rejected. And we just saw last week a major 50 militias came together in Damascus, in the suburbs of Damascus, and they carried the black flag of jihad, not the Syrian flag, and they announced that they reject the Syrian National Council, which America spent 3 years putting together. They reject the Supreme Military Command that America has organized based in Turkey and is trying to run the Free Syrian Army. They just said, none of this. We're not taking this. This is a foreign conspiracy. We want Islam. And we're not going to put up with this sort of nonsense. America's not coming to our aid. And so you've got a very different world that is emerging in Syria today as a product of this conflict. And the stakes are very high because it's become extremely sectarian and it's become very class-oriented. And the upper class are leaving and the minorities are leaving. And the minorities are the ones, and particularly the Alawite minority, which is about 12%, that have been trying to suppress this and have killed tons of Sunni Arabs. And when they lose, and should they lose, there's going to be real hell to pay on their part. And that's why it's taken this ethnic dimension. It's going to be very difficult. But the Christians and other religious minorities have glommed on to this Alawites, and they're fearful, and they're going to pay as well. And so you're going to get a reorganization, as we've seen in Iraq, with lots of minorities fleeing the country. And that's what's – this nation-building process is going on. It's a very bloody process. And that's – it's not just about reform. It's about who's going to win in this. And there are going to be very definite losers, and there are going to be winners. And it's not unlike our own civil war, where 700,000 people – were killed, and Southern nationalism was extinguished. And there were winners. The Yankees won. And they got to rule over the others. And that was a bloody, bloody process that helped define who we were as a nation, our values, and our identity. And that's in a sense what's going on in places like Syria today.
Well, I'm going to stick with Syria then and go back to you, Kelly, because obviously you've seen some incredible things there. And given what you've seen and the stories that you've told us, how do you feel about the regime in Syria? And what should the international community or even perhaps the United States do in response? I want to make you take a position on that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a journalist, you know, and I can tell you what I've seen and what I've reported, because since, you know, reporting on that reporting trip where I played you those pieces with these activists, these young Syrians, who I would argue are still there, because I've seen them and I've been inside the country many, many, many times over the last 2.5 years. A lot of them have left, but they're not all gone. The place isn't totally overrun with Islamic terrorists. Not everybody's flying the black flag. And even when they do fly the black flag, it doesn't necessarily mean they believe in jihad. I have to say that, but a lot of what I do agree with what you say, because I do think this rebel movement, after we covered these activists, we watched them. I watched Ibrahim, my flag-waving friend. I watched him as he picked up guns and joined a militia and decided to fight. And I went back to him over and over and over again over the years, like I said, and to sort of try to understand what it was all about. And we do know that it's a very disparate group. When you talk about the United States getting involved, arming the rebels, I mean, and you hear these questions, I think rightly so, from American officials. Who are the rebels? I mean, it's a great question. And I can answer it because I've been with them, and I've lived with them, and I've stayed with them, and I've followed them around. And I can say that they're, you know, it depends on what town you're in. I mean, it differs from village to village. It differs from month to month who they are, whether they are jihadists or not. We've seen more and more jihadists come in, that's for sure. But what I can say is that, and we also know that they themselves have committed atrocities, no question. Absolutely no question. We've seen horrific crimes committed at the hands of these rebels, these guys who started out as protesters, picked up guns. They all came from the same place, you know. We've seen them try to lie to us and practice their own forms of propaganda, just like the regime did. I mean, they all sort of grew up from the same place. But what we've also seen time and over again in these towns and villages is an unbelievable level of violence directed at civilians by the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Yes, his threat is existential. He sees his threat as existential. He believes, he and the people surrounding him, I think, believe that if they lose, all Alawites will lose. That is a fear of his. I do not think that's what this uprising was about from the beginning. But the sense is that he will fight to the last drop of blood to preserve himself and his group. And what does that mean on the ground, in real terms, every day in Syria? It means that schools are bombed by airplanes. It means that Scud missiles, which are supposed to be used against tank battalions, I mean, they're big and they're really imprecise. And the reason you fire a Scud missile is so you can just take out a whole row of tanks. They fire them at civilian neighborhoods in cities. It takes out an entire block of people. I've seen it. I've been there. You know, people waiting in line for bread get bombed with a mortar or a rocket. Again, rebels have done bad things, but I can tell you that the blame, by and large, rests with the regime. Tens of thousands of people have been killed, and they're willing to kill their own people, as we saw with the chemical attack. A willingness to kill your own people for your own survival. That's how I would characterize this regime.
So given that, what is your reaction, Samer and Joshua? Let's each give you each a chance because, you know, if this is what we're hearing from Kelly, is the situation on the ground, how can anyone justify not intervening?
Right. Well, there are a couple of things. Kelly forgot cluster bombs and aerial bombardment, both by fixed wing and you know, whatever, helicopters and so on. And this is a terrible regime. And there's no question that at the beginning, this was non-sectarian. When people went out in Deraa and then later elsewhere, they were not calling for a Sunni majority state and so on. They were, like their fellow citizens in Tunisia and Egypt, calling for democratic governance, as well as economic justice. There's no question that there was an economic component to the Arab uprisings. But it was also in the regime's interest to transform it into a sectarian conflict for a number of reasons. It became existential. It also tied other minority groups to the regime in a way that made their exit from the regime impossible, right? So I think that, you know, it is the case that we've seen horrific things from the rebels, the opposition, and so on. But the extent of violence, the character of this regime is just unacceptable. Now, if you get into the Eisenhower room in the White House and you talk about what national security interests are, most people will say that, you know, this is not a question of U.S. national security interests. And I wouldn't make the argument that, you know, U.S. national security depends on the Assad regime falling. But I will say that the United States is the only country in the world that has the capability of doing something. And I'm not certainly proposing sending, you know, young boys and girls from Oklahoma or New Jersey to Syria to determine the outcome. But and this administration deserves a tremendous amount of blame for not acting and not acting earlier, when I think some kind of intervention could have had or was more likely to have some determinative impact on the outcome. But, and we've talked about this before, I believe the United States has a moral obligation to act. And what that means, I think, quite specifically, would be tilting the balance of power in Syria now, possibly through the use of cruise and Pershing missiles to wipe out some runways so that the Syrians can't get resupply shipments from Iran and Russia and so on, not to determine the outcome, but so that it would change the strategic calculation of Bashar al-Assad, so that he thinks that he's going to have a fate like Mr. Gaddafi's or a fate like Zayn al-Abidin bin Ali. He can go to, not Saudi Arabia in his case, to another country and live the life of luxury and so on and not get killed on the side of the road. Because right now he thinks and the regime thinks they can survive this, that they can live another day and so on. And as long as that's the case, the level of killing and violence is going to continue. And, you know, we differ on this. We're still very good friends, but we differ on this. And you asked me what I thought the United States should do, and that's what I think the United States should do.
Well, I have to go to Joshua. Moral obligation?
You know, what we have in Syria, a place like Syria, is an ethnic renegotiation. Throughout the Middle East, the Levant part of the Middle East, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Palestine, colonial powers at the end when they destroyed the Ottoman Empire and made little countries out of this big multi-ethnic empire that was like the Austro-Hungarian Empire in Central Europe, they carved out these little countries and they stuck a bunch of people, they couldn't have done it any other way, together who didn't really want to live with each other, like Czechs and Slovaks or Serbs and Bosnians and so forth. And that hasn't worked. And what they did is they put minorities, because the minorities clung to the colonials, in power, or they give them a foot up in every one of these countries. So you ended up with Maronites having a lion's share of power, Maronite Christians in Lebanon, Alawites getting a lion's share of power in Syria, Sunnis 20% in Iraq holding all the power, and the Jewish minority in Palestine, too, which in 48, when the British left, had a third of the population, but was able to defeat the Palestinians pretty roundly. And all of those minorities have lost their hold on power because in this age of popular revolt and demand for justice and democratic rule, the majority ethnic group isn't going to sit under these minorities. And so the Maronites, who are very educated people in Lebanon, clung to power desperately for 15 years, drugged their country through 15 years of bloody civil war with 200,000 being killed out of 3 million, and they lost. They didn't quite lose because America and Israel came and helped them out a little bit. But they might lose in the future. Iraq, the Sunnis, America destroyed them. In the name of democracy, we threw them down to the bottom of society, catapulted the Shiites, who are about 60% up to the top, and Maliki government is almost all Shiite. He has rooted out the Sunnis in his militias in particular. And the Sunnis have all become al-Qaeda guys. And they become, in a sense, they become extremists because they were cast out. America didn't know they were going to do this because we just were ignorant about Iraq. We thought we were going to bring democracy. Mm. But what we were doing is fiddling with a very explosive sectarian misbalance. And in some ways, it's good we did, because it's better to have 60% Shiites ruling over the others than to have the 20% Sunnis ruling over the others. So it's a little bit more democratic, I suppose. But what we're doing is we're reaching in and resetting. And we've done that in the Arab-Israeli conflict, in a sense, by giving a total win to the Jews, or helping the Jews get a total win. They got it largely on their own, but they got a lot of help from the West. And the Palestinians have destabilized the Middle East for 50 years. They have been behind what grew into international terrorism. Sirhan Sirhan, who killed Robert Kennedy, was trying to avenge the Palestinian cause. I mean, it has been on us for a long time. So we have reached in and tried to rejigger the ethnic balance in the Arab-Israeli conflict. It's come back to bite us. We've done it in Iraq, and we got out with our tail between our legs, and now there were over 1,000 people killed last month because Sunnis and Shiites are at each other's neck. Lebanon is still a tinderbox. And we can't go into Syria and say, okay, we're going to give the Sunnis a win, unless we protect the minorities. And we can do that if we get an international coalition, hundreds of thousands of troops, put them in, create an ethnic enclave for the minorities, which we could do along the coast because they're a compact minority. The coast area of Syria is majority Alawite, for example. But you need an international force. You need lots of money. And nobody's going to do that. So then you get the, well, let's just bomb them a little bit and change the balance of power, which is in a sense what Samer is arguing for and which many other people are arguing for, because it's cheaper. And the American people might be able to swallow that kind of a commitment. But if you just bomb them and change the balance of power, there's going to be ethnic cleansing. And if you don't think there's ethnic cleansing, going to be ethnic cleansing, I think you're foolish. And so it's irresponsible to think that you can just do a pinprick method and somehow control the outcome. You can't. You've got to go in all the way and say what the vision of future Syria is going to be, and then you've got to make that happen, as we've tried to make it happen in Afghanistan and tried to make it happen in Iraq at the tune of $1 trillion and other things. But if you just think you're going to bomb it, you're going to get a Libya, which is in total disrepair. And that's not good.
Well, I see some potential disagreement here, but I think it's wise to maybe to close our discussion here and open it up to the discussion in the audience here in just a second. I just want to end with this. I mean, conversations about these violent uprisings in the Middle East are anything but uplifting. So I have to ask each of you, if you could just end quickly with, what is it, you know, about what can we be hopeful? Where are there any rays of light?
Tunisia, Yemen. I didn't cover Tunisia, so it's not one that I follow closely. But Yemen, actually, a really fascinating case. Here's a country that is, you know, awash in guns. When you say Yemen, what is your image? Your vision is not of a peaceful, wonderful place. It's a place that is a haven to one of the sort of affiliates of Al-Qaeda, a place where people have actually tried to launch attacks against Americans, have launched attacks in Saudi Arabia. But at the same time, you know, it's this interesting case where the dictator wasn't ousted violently, but kind of. He kind of was, right? I mean, he was actually attacked. He cracked down on his protesters for several months. Many people died. The people stayed fast. They had this tent city that was about 2 miles long in the capital, Sana'a, and I spent a lot of time there. And they wouldn't give up. They were relentless. And about 7 or 8 months into the uprising, there was an attack on him, and he was very badly injured. I mean, I think that helped precipitate his exit from power, but it was also enormous diplomatic pressure from two powers with great interest in Yemen, and that's the United States and Saudi Arabia, and eventually, you know, got him to leave power. He stepped down on his own volition. And I think when you see a country like that, same with Tunisia, where the leader wasn't ousted violently, I think there's a lot of hope. But There's actually been studies done on this. When power changes hands nonviolently, you've got a lot more hope that something, that the outcome is going to be okay. Yemen is in the middle of a 2-year national dialogue process. You've got factions from all over the place coming to the table, sitting down. People are throwing shoes at each other, throwing chairs at each other. It's super messy. There's a caretaker president. I mean, who knows how it's going to turn out, but it's fascinating to watch because that's what it's about. It's about the process. It's about the democratic process and how does a country put itself together after it's had one of these autocratic leaders for more than 30 years. He steps down and the people actually get a say in how it gets remade again. That sounds pretty cool to me.
I'm going to Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, I think Yemen certainly, and it's also important to point out that both Saudi Arabia and the United States were not pushing for democratic outcomes in Yemen.
Their interests were much, yes.
Much different. And in fact, it's because of Saudi Arabia and the United States. When Ali Abdullah Saleh was bombed and burned badly, he went to Saudi Arabia for treatment. And it is mind-boggling why anyone interested in a stable, peaceful Yemen would allow him to return, which is what the Saudis did. In any case, I think Yemen, certainly to some extent, Tunisia, and I think that also the region has witnessed something very transformative, even if the outcomes today are not necessarily democratic. We were speaking about this earlier. You know, there's this possibly apocryphal exchange between Henry Kissinger and Ho Chi Minh at the Paris peace talks when Henry Kissinger asked Ho Chi Minh what he thought of the French Revolution, and the Vietnamese communist leader replied and said, "It's still too early to tell." But I do think the important point of this is that we have seen an end of an era of presidents and dictators for life, an end of an era when people in the Arab world felt that authoritarianism was their fate. And still in Syria, what is remarkable from a social science perspective in a way is that people are still going out into the streets and protesting and knowing that the outcome might be death. And so this fear barrier or whatever you want to call it, and youth activism, certainly conceptions of citizenship and that of political efficacy and so on, I think that's changed in the entire region, and that's certainly a positive thing.
Joshua, last word. Are you optimistic?
You know, in the long run, I'm optimistic. Tons of people in the last few decades have moved from poverty into middle classdom, particularly in the fortunate countries like China, India, Brazil, Turkey, the BRIC countries that have been growing at 8%, 10%, 12% a year. Extraordinary positive story about human development in much of the world. Of course, we're going, every 10 years, we're adding another billion people onto the globe, and it's hard to keep up. And places like the Middle East, unfortunately, at least in the last few decades, have been the losers. Africa, the Middle East, are the two regions that have been the losers in terms of economic growth. And the same income gap that we're seeing yawning in America due to globalization, where the people with knowledge and some savvy are getting rich, but the 50% at the bottom who don't have that are getting poorer, and they're going to get clobbered by the competition with a world of hungry people who are getting educated and are beginning to compete with them. And that's what's happening with the larger Middle East. And the fact that there is very terrible, very bad education on the whole in the Middle East. Underfunded, bad growth. You look at the numbers. Yemen, I'm not optimistic. Why? Not because I know Yemen very well, but because the average age in Yemen is 19 years old. Gaza and Yemen have the two youngest populations. 50% of Yemenis are under 19. And the poverty level is over 40%, $2 a day or less. These people have got nothing. And for them to come out well in a world that is so competitive today, I hope they do. And I want to be positive about it, but I'm not. And I'm not positive about a lot of the countries in the Middle East. Tunisia might make it. Their median age is 30 years old. They have much higher per capita GDP. They're bigger middle class. They've got all these indicators that suggest they might just make it through that democratic lurch. But the other countries, not very positive, at least today. until they get much better government and begin to grow and get educated, where the young people can get jobs and be productive citizens. And that's a very difficult – it's going to be a real struggle for both Africa, many African countries and many Middle Eastern countries to get through that and do what Turkey has done, do what Iran hopefully will do if they can get these sanctions off them, because they've had some very positive things going on in Iran. But you see this happening, but not everywhere. And there are going to be countries that fall through the cracks and become the Hades of the next world. And the Middle East is on a line. We don't know which way it's going to go, and that's the danger.
Well, I should have let him go first. On that note, please join me in thanking first, before we open to the public, thanking our panelists. Tremendous wealth of information. So I believe you have volunteers in the audience to come to you with a microphone if you'd like to ask a question to one of our panelists.
Hello. I'm Lester Asamoah, international security and Arabic major here at University of Oklahoma. My question would be, so you just mentioned Iran and how a lot of the positive things are happening currently. I know one of the things that have been happening is the president has been coming out and trying to renegotiate with the Americans and really try to change the shape of politics in the Middle East as a whole. Will that have any effect on the situation in Syria or anything else in the Middle East as a whole, or is this something where it'll fall through as many other diplomatic negotiations have with Iran in the past?
You know, this is the big question, because we've seen the Shiite-Sunni divide that has just polarized the Middle East and polarized countries like Syria and Iraq. And are so dangerous. They're tinderboxes that are ready to explode and make things a lot worse. And we need diplomacy. We also have terrible sanctions on Iran, which I have become increasingly a real opponent of sanctions. We just had a speaker here the other day who said sanctions work. But in many places, they don't work. What they do is they impoverish people. And then you don't get out through this democratic leap, because one of the things you do need for democracy, or at least in most places, is a healthy middle class. And if we grind people into the dirt over 15, 20 years of economic sanctions, you're not going to get democracy. You're going to get a lot of angry people. And you might be able to destroy them and get what you want, but you can't – you don't make a healthy country. And so diplomacy is very important. There are a lot of things working against it. The Iranians are very proud. They want their nuclear process, and they've got a regime that is very stubbornly determined to do it. And how we're going to get them to stop, because that's our objective, I'm not sure.
I guess I would just say a couple of things. I mean, the question was specific – I thought, at least, it was specifically about to what extent will a possible – if not rapprochement, bettering of relations between the U.S. and Iran lead to some progress on the Syrian front. And in fact, you know, and I've only been casually following the doings or happenings between Iran and the United States over the last, you know, decade or two. It doesn't seem like the crux of the matter right now is Syria. In fact, that's not really issue number one. It's Iran's nuclear program. So, and that's certainly primary in the minds of President Obama and the Iranian leadership. So it's not necessarily the case that the Iranians are going to stop arming or give up supporting Bashar al-Assad. And then the other point I would make is simply the following one. And it's not a point that I'm only putting forward. It's a point that I think people who were formerly in the National Security Council, specifically Bruce Rydell, would put forward. And that is that it is in the national interests of Iran to achieve nuclear capacity, right, capability. It is in their interests. I mean, Iran a few years ago, when there were 100,000 troops in Afghanistan and 100,000 troops in Iraq, was essentially surrounded by the United States. It looks at the region and it sees a very powerful, militarily, technologically sophisticated Israel, which is quite hostile to Iran as the major military power in the region, and it sees a hostile United States since 1979 that would love to have regime change in Iran. It's also learned the lesson of the Bush 2 administration, which is this is the North Korea lesson, if you have a nuclear bomb, you will survive and you won't be attacked by the United States. So if I was a National Security Council advisor advising Ali Khamenei as to what he should do, it would be to go for a nuclear bomb, but the difference is to achieve nuclear capability as opposed to building a bomb. That is, the ability and the technological know-how to assemble a bomb in 6 months as opposed to making a bomb. Because making a bomb then leads to the possibility and a justified possibility in the minds of some of the Israelis or the United States saying you've crossed a red line and we're going to attack and so on. So it is quite rational for Iran to pursue this. Moreover, and others have said this not very loudly, we can live with a nuclear Iran. We can live with a nuclear Iran. Pakistan is much more unstable as a political system than Iran, and they have nuclear weapons, and it's not the best of worlds, but it's a world that we can live in. Iran has shown, I would argue, a great deal of responsibility, and I'm in no way defending an authoritarian regime, but I am saying that has a miserable human rights record and isn't characterized by the rule of law and so on. But nevertheless, it is not an existential threat, I think, for the United States, and I don't even think it's an existential threat for Israel.
And just really quickly, I mean, we don't think Syria is really on the table in these negotiations. But, you know, if some kind of conversation is in the offing as these conversations go forward, there are a lot of people who think that wouldn't be a bad thing, right? I mean, I think in the administration sort of dream world, the balance is tipped on the battlefield and Bashar al-Assad somehow miraculously wants to go to Geneva and negotiate himself out of power. Seems kind of far-fetched. But if that's going to happen, it's going to have to involve Iran. Iran would have to be, almost have to be involved in that conversation. I think it's not just the other powers can't just rely on Russia to put the pressure on him. They would want Iran in that conversation.
Eldridge Luber is my name. A couple of weeks ago, Mike Morrell, I think I got that name right, was on 60 Minutes, and he said he's former second-in-command at the CIA, and he said there's four things going on in Syria, and I understood three of them. The one I didn't understand was he said it's a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Could you talk about that?
Essentially, Syria is about what's happening in Syria and in between a public that has been oppressed for a long time by a very narrow sectarian government. But it also has a regional dimension, and it's part of this. Iran is a Shiite power. It has supported the Alawites, this minority, Shiite minority, that has ruled over Syria for 40 years and has become, a very close ally. And that's connected to Hezbollah in Lebanon. And all of those Shiite communities are supported by Iran. Saudi Arabia sees itself as the king of the Sunnis in the same way that Iran is sort of the mothership for Shiites throughout the region. And Saudi Arabia doesn't like Shiites and is trying to get rid and weaken. It was very upset, Saudi Arabia, when we helped the Shiites to power, Maliki to power in Iraq, and we threw down Saddam Hussein because it turned Iraq into a Shiite-governed country that cleaved to Iran. So all of a sudden, Saudi Arabia is looking north, and not only did they have a threatening Iran over there on the other side of the Gulf, but they had this big Shiite power to their north now. So it was much worse than Saddam's day for them. And they're worried. This also got Syria, and it creates this big arc, what they call the Shiite crescent on top of them. And Saudi Arabia believes that if they can topple the Alawite regime in Syria and help a friendly Sunni government into power, that Sunni government will be dependent on Saudi Arabia rather than Iran, and this would make up for the loss of Iraq, in a sense, and would give them a firm Sunni ally. They would have clipped the ears of Iran and kept it out of the heart of the Middle East, and then they would be able to take out Hezbollah and bring Lebanon back into the Sunni fold, because Hezbollah would be isolated off near the Mediterranean coast without Syria to bind it together with this Iranian Shiite crescent. And that's a plan that's shared by the United States. Many people in the United States encourage that and are, you know, helping us work with Saudi Arabia so that we can get rid of and diminish Iranian power. So it is have this big – and Russia is supporting Iran. And so it's become even bigger than just the Shiite Sunni. It's become the flavor of Cold War is sort of, you know, rising in the back of people's mouths.
Just one thing to add about this, and you know, Joshua is completely correct, but there is a tendency, unfortunately, particularly the last few years, to look at the Middle East exclusively through a Shia-Sunni prism. And in fact, I think that you can explain much of regional politics in the region without that prism and simply recourse to sheer power politics. We have to remember that when the Shah of Iran was in charge from before 1953, when the United States ousted a democratically elected prime minister in Iran to put the Shah back in, until 1979, Shia country and so on, they had very good relations with Saudi Arabia and very good relations with Egypt, two major Sunni powers. And so there is a great deal of tension and rivalry and hostility between now the Islamic Republic of Iran, which after the revolution proclaimed an Islamic revolution not just in Iran but throughout the region and threatened the Saudi royal family, incidentally, one of the countries that is less democratic and has a more abysmal human rights record than Iran, and so on. And so it is not simply a Sunni-Shia thing. We have a tendency, unfortunately, to think of the region as being Sunnis hate Shia and the Shia hate Sunni, when in fact, in many cases, these are regimes which are rivals and want to have regional influence and so on. They happen to be, in this case, Sunni and Shia. But in the past, we can see they got along quite nicely, and they were both aligned with the United States during that period as well. So,
Hi. Elizabeth Moyer. I am a international security major, Arabic minor, junior. I have two questions for you. They both have to do with predicting the future, so I understand if you can't answer correctly. First of all, how do you see political enfranchisement of Arabs in the Middle East involved in these kinds of conflicts? Right now, one of their problems is they can't be involved in politics. How do you see political parties forming and voting? And then specifically, can you talk about what would happen in Syria if Bashar al-Assad does fall? Do you see it happening more akin to Egypt or based on previous examples? There's no written story for countries after this happens, but how do you see that happening?
Well, I'll just answer the second part, and I don't know what's going to happen, but I can tell you what officials are really afraid of. And I think it's important to understand why the administration has been really reluctant on Syria, although I don't think I'll ever totally understand it. They've really got Iraq in the rearview mirror. You know, we went in, the United States government and the United States Army went in and wiped out a regime in a very short amount of time. Not only did we topple Saddam, but, you know, Paul Bremer fired 50,000 members of the ruling Ba'ath Party, which basically dismantled the entire state. You know, in a matter of a pen stroke, the state was dismantled. So I think the question of what would happen after Bashar is the question that plagues the administration and the policymakers in Washington. You know, we know that that was a bad idea, right? So what do you do instead? How do you, and I think a lot of, you know, what's happening in Egypt, I think helps us think about that, right? What's going right? What's going wrong in Egypt? In Egypt, there's this thing called sort of the so-called deep state. You know, you might get rid of the leader, but the state remains. Egypt has the biggest, you know, bureaucracy in the region. You know, millions of people working for the government. You don't kick them all out. What do you do? And so I think as negotiators, you know, and again in this dream scenario where they're all sitting down in Geneva and negotiating how to get rid of Bashar, it'd be a process of figuring out who gets to stay, you know, and who has to leave? And how do you do that? I mean, I think that's an extremely complicated situation. And when they leave, where do they go? You know, do they immediately go to the International Criminal Court? I mean, these are things that just haven't really been done before and obviously shouldn't be done by outside powers, should be done by Syrians themselves. When you have an opposition that's completely divided and a mess, I mean, there's the roadmap is not at all clear toward that.
Yeah, one last question.
I didn't answer.
My name is Anu Pugalia, and I'm an OU alum. And I was wondering if you think that the uprisings could spread to some other countries in the Middle East, like, for example, Jordan or Saudi Arabia, where I know Kelly reported from quite a bit.
Saudi Arabia.
And
no.
I was also wondering what you think the way forward is in Egypt. You know, would it have been better if Mubarak was still in power? Because I see more chaos now than there was, you know, back then.
Yeah, I don't know much about Jordan. I just haven't covered it. I can say, having lived in Saudi Arabia, I mean, my guess is no. That, you know, seeing how the Saudi regime reacted to the uprising in neighboring Bahrain by sending in tanks and APCs and Apache helicopters to dismantle this, you know, uprising on this tiny island, that, and seeing how they reacted when there was sort of, there was like one day that was supposed to be the Saudi day of rage, and I think this is early on in the Arab uprisings where it was literally just, you know, contagious. I think maybe 50 people protested and, you know, they cracked down on all of them, kicked all the any journalist who covered it, kicked them out. I mean, it was this teeny little protest. And to see how they reacted to that is pretty telling of how they would probably not tolerate something going forward. Egypt is you.
So I'll just, and I'll also just add a footnote to what was just said. And while I completely agree with you that the prospects of an uprising leading to the ouster of the El Saud regime is very unlikely, it is the case that in every single Arab state, with the exception of Qatar, there were major protests after the fall of Bin Ali. In Mauritania, in Morocco, which led to constitutional amendments, in Algeria, in the states that fell, in Saudi Arabia, in the eastern province, there were weekly several thousand people, mostly Shia, marginalized and disenfranchised and so on, out. In Kuwait, the biggest protests in Kuwaiti history, the GDP per capita of Kuwait is probably close to double that of the United States for Kuwaiti citizens. In Oman, there were major protests. In the UAE, there were a few bloggers and activists. So this was contagion. It spread all over the place. And then with regard to Egypt, just very briefly, no, Mubarak, we're very glad that he's no longer with us, and almost any outcome is better than Mubarak or his son. But with regard to the future, and this is where I'm, you know, equally pessimistic as my colleague with regard to Egypt, I mean, when we think about Egypt 2.5 years ago, if we think about what people were demanding civilian control of the military, they were demanding to be respected as citizens, rule of law, elections to mean something, social justice, and so on. 2.5 years afterwards, particularly with the non-democratic ouster of Mr. Morsi on July 3rd, the coup, and the military now back in charge, we are very, very far from achieving those goals. So in that sense, I'm pessimistic in the short term.
Another ending pessimistic.
One last word?
I'm fine.
Right. Well, Kelly McEvers, Samer Shahata, and Joshua Landis, thank you all for your contributions to this very interesting and important discussion. Thank you.
This has been a special 2-hour edition of Oklahoma Voices through a programmatic partnership with KGOU's Worldviews and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. You can hear this entire conversation on our website, kgou.org. The views and opinions expressed during this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of KGOU, its staff, or our licensee, the University of Oklahoma. Thanks to KGOU Chief Engineer Patrick Roberts for recording this broadcast for air. You can hear Kelly McEvers talking about some of the challenges women journalists face in the Middle East this Friday at 4 and 6:30 during Worldviews. For KGOU and Oklahoma Voices, I'm Brian Hartzinski.